former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced four documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire, creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Now, welcome, all you true crime fans. Welcome to the beautiful Studio 4, the Big Dumb Fun Show, and the classic old Ice House building in Midtown Kansas City. I'm here with my good friend and co-host, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
We're also back with my good friend, Troy Cole. Say hello, Troy.
Hello.
As you know, we're not dealing with the mob tonight. We've dealt with the mob a lot. We've done another serial killer show, Richard Grissom, with my good friend Joe Langer and Tommy Robinson, which was a pretty compelling show.
Well, they were the guys that worked the Metro Patrol for the case.
They were the Metro Squad, yeah.
The Metro Squad.
And that's what we like to do, as you guys know. We like to get the story from the mouths of the men who did it, whether it be the policemen or the crooks. We've had Craig Glazier, the King of Sting. We've had Martin J. McNally, the Skyjacker, the D.B. Cooper wannabe.
We've had...
Or lookalike. I shouldn't say wannabe. I don't want to denigrate
He's a copycat criminal.
He's a copycat, or he is D.B. Cooper.
He could be D.B. Cooper.
That's what Aaron wants
to believe. You need to go listen to the episodes. There's seven of them.
There is. They're compelling as hell.
Where we sit and talk with Martin J. McNally and go back and look at the photos. And you decide if you think maybe, just maybe, that Martin J. McNally is, in fact, D.B. Cooper.
And
I kind of think he is.
You do. And he's spending some of that $100,000 they never did find, or however much it was. It was in the six figures. I remember that. They found a little bit of it up in the Columbia River. He must have dropped some of it on his way out.
You know, and now he's off paper, so who knows?
Yeah, he's probably gone back and found that money where he buried it.
He was waiting to get off paper.
He's been waiting
just
for
so he could
35
go back
years, 38
that,
years to go back
time.
And dig that money up. Well, you know,
or maybe not.
Or maybe not.
You decide if you'd listen to it and then let us know.
Right.
What you think.
That's a good idea. Facebook or Gangland Wire Facebook or at Jinklaw on Twitter or
just go
ganglandwire at gmail.com.
Go to our iTunes and leave a review.
Tell us, that would be nice.
I think this is D.B. Cooper. Or not.
Or not.
We'd like to know what you think.
Leave us a bad review and say, these guys are full of crap. This isn't D.B. Cooper. Why do they keep telling us it's D.B. Cooper?
Because maybe someone will think it is.
I'll take even a bad review to get some more reviews. I want reviews.
Yeah. Well, now...
All right, let's get started.
What we really have, though, again, from the mouth of the men that did it, we have a sergeant from the Kansas City Police Department who worked from 1972 until you worked 25 years, Troy?
Yes.
Until you retired. And in that time, you worked for the Homicide Department or Division, Homicide Squad. And you, along with 33 or 34 other uniformed officers, took care
plain
of
clothes officers.
Yeah.
Now you got to straighten him out on this police thing every once in a while.
So if you're working homicide, you don't have to wear a uniform.
You don't wear a uniform. Oh, no, man. You're plain clothes.
Just walk around in a suit and tie.
Yes.
They don't even do that anymore.
No, they don't. They wear polo shirts and khaki slacks,
yeah,
seem like anymore.
Now.
But you guys were busy. 130 murders a year.
Correct.
And used to solve those in leisure suits.
And back then, if you didn't solve about 75% of them, you had the brass coming down on you because what's going on. And I think now they solve about 40-something percent.
That's so right. It's totally opposite.
It's just really gone downhill.
I don't understand that.
I don't
I've
either.
Never figured it out. But.
Well, after you retired, then you wrote a book, Rites
actually,
of Burial.
I wrote the book while I was still on the police department.
Oh, really?
And actually, let me correct you a little bit. I didn't do the writing. Tom Jackman did the writing.
Well, you wrote like rough draft of your experiences and your memories, and then Tom polished it.
I supplied the information, and he polished it up
into
where it was in presentable form.
Because Tom wasn't there, you were.
Right.
Correct.
He was hovering around the edges. He reported on the story, I think, but he wasn't there.
He covered it on a daily basis.
Yeah. I think he's with the Washington Post now, isn't he?
Yes.
He wasn't with animal control.
No, he wasn't out there in that stinky house, was he? Well, anyhow, bring us back up to date, Aaron. You've got a better memory than I do. I'll make it into a too long a story.
I'm trying to find the date that you said that you walked into the house. That was
April 2nd.
April 2nd.
1988.
1988. The house located at 4315 Charlotte here in Kansas City, Missouri. House still there?
No, they tore it down. The reason they tore it down was because the neighbors complained. They were starting to take tour buses out of town, tour buses by there. Everybody wanted to get pictures of it, and it became a real issue for the residents who lived in the neighborhood. So they did a lot of complaining, and a few years later, the city tore it down.
But in the intervening time between April 2nd, there you were. You were working the desk. You get a call. They tell you, we got a naked guy with a dog collar, and we're not sure what it is, but we're going to continue to investigate it. And they basically continue to investigate it, and then Bob Bordella drives up on his own home, and there's officers there kind of surveilling the house as you guys are getting a warrant to search the house. And they take Bob in. They bring him down to the station. You said they brought him to the second floor, and that's where you had a few minutes with him where the officers basically said, we want to go ahead and may I charge him. You charge him, you book him, you put him in a holding cell of some sort there at the station, and in the intervening time, they put together a search warrant, and a lot of people come out to Bob Bordella's house to go through that front door, including animal control.
Yes.
And you. So you get a big guy, kicks the door in, animal control goes in because he's got chows. They're alleging that there's these animals, these dogs in there. Animal control apprehends the dogs. And then you guys go in.
Yes.
So, Troy, and it stunk to high heaven.
Yeah, it was horrible. Again, it was so cluttered, you literally kind of had to walk around and step over things. There was newspapers, magazines, furniture in disarray. You name it. The kitchen was so piled with dirty dishes. Again, there was a big pot with a nasty turkey carcass in it that had been there for days. But
Troy, how do you organize something like that? You just don't just.
What I did, I assigned a room. It was a large house. It had a basement and three floors, and I assigned detectives to go to various rooms and just take one room at a time. And what we were trying to do was to find something that could verify the story that Chris Bryson had told us. He told us that he had been tethered to a bed for 5 days and that he had been injected with all kind of narcotics. He had been tortured by various means
and sodomized.
So we went through the house trying to find something to substantiate his story.
Well, he had said he climbed out of a third-story window.
Yes.
So you go up there to the third floor.
So you're looking for the place he was tied to.
We're looking for the bed that he had described.
Syringes and narcotics.
He had told us there was a tray beside the bed that had a bunch of syringes and drugs on it. He gave us a pretty good description of what to look for. And so first, we had trouble finding the room that he had described, but a short time later, one of the detectives yelled out. He said, "Hey, Sarge, I think I found it." So we go in, and there's a room on that room happened to be on the second floor that he had described. And it was a bed, and the tethers that they had used to keep him tied had been burned, and that's one of the things he told us in the story. He said that... He said the only reason the only way he could stay alive was to escape, because Bordella, during the course of the 5 days of torture, Bordella had told him, you know, you're never going to leave this house. I've killed others before, and if you don't cooperate, you're going to be next. So he said, you know, he got to thinking the only way I'm going to get out of here is to escape, because he's not going to turn me loose. So it happened to be during the NCAA basketball tournament that was being held in Kansas City. And Chris had told him, he said, you know, if you could tie my hands down in front of me where I could use the remote control, there was a television at the foot of the bed. He said, if you would tie my hands down here, I could change the channel and watch TV while you're gone. Berdella would leave each morning and go to his flea market, which was located over in Westmore. Obviously, we didn't know that at the time, but he would leave every day and leave Chris Bryson tethered. And Chris would
say he's watching the basketball game.
He wanted to watch the basketball game, so he talked Bob into tying his hands from up over his head down in front of him in his lap where he could use the remote control. He had spotted a book of matches that was near the bed, and he thought, if I could get him to tie my hands down in front of me, I could reach the matches. I could maybe burn through the tethers and escape. And that's exactly what he did. Berdella agreed to tie his hands down in front of him on that particular Saturday morning before he went to work. And Chris burned through the restraints. He had told him, he said, if you ever try to get away from here, Berdella had told him, he said, those chow dogs will eat you alive. And again, he's up on the second floor. The dogs are kept on the first floor. So Chris believed him, and he was afraid to try to go down the steps. So he thought, the only way for me to get out of here is to go through the window. So once he burned through the restraints, he goes over to the window, and he's trying to hang out and kind of lower himself down to where he can take a gentle fall. But the windowsill was rotten, and it broke, and he fell, broke his ankle when he hit the ground. Hobbles out into the street. There happens to be a water meter reader walking down the street. Chris sees him, and he runs up to him and starts screaming, "Hey, man, I need some help. I've been terrorized and held captive." And at that point, the meter reader takes him over to a nearby house. They call the police, and that's how we got involved in it.
So you're inside the house, and you find one of the early things you find that you know you got a case. You know you're going to be able to charge him the next day with sodomy, forcible sodomy, when you find that bed, and it's exactly like your victim reported. So then you settle back and start searching for more things.
Right. We find the tray. It was a metal tray that had several syringes, different types of drugs. And then we continue our search throughout the house. And a short time later, one of the detectives looked under a mattress in one of the other bedrooms. And there's an envelope containing Polaroid photographs. A couple of hundred of them, as I recall.
Is this the manila envelope that said house guest on it? House guest on it?
That was separate.
That was different.
Okay. Yeah, that was different. That was kept down on the first floor.
But this was in a room on the second floor.
This was up on the second floor and underneath a mattress. And there was a couple hundred photographs, as I recall. And it showed several different people in various stages of, well, some of them were being tortured. Some of them were not. Then we found another section of Polaroids that contained pictures of Chris Bryson, where he had been tied up. So that pretty much verified his story and the fact that we've got photographs showing him tied to the bed and being tortured and sodomized.
You got it
sodomized.
Now. You got that case made but, now.
That case feels pretty good at that point.
Was that in the same envelope or a different envelope?
That was in a different envelope.
Different envelope. Was that in the same room or a different room?
I think that was in a different room, as I recall.
So you're finding these pictures.
Did you ever find the Polaroid camera?
Yes, there was a Polaroid camera laying in the bedroom also.
Then these pictures are leading you to believe more than just Chris Bryson has been a victim in this house, it sounds like.
Yeah, possibly. Although some of the pictures, there was group shots of four or five guys standing around with their arms around each other, smiling and mugging for the camera. There was a lot of that. But there was also a lot of pictures where people looked like they were being...
They were not happy.
They were not happy and probably not there of their own free will.
Did they? Yeah, they appear to be bound.
Yeah, lots of them. They were tethered to the same bed that Bryson had evidently escaped from.
Oh, you could tell that.
Because the bed had the headboard was metal, and it had like five. They were like wrought iron, 1-inch wrought iron posts, and the paint was wore off of several of the posts, whereas it almost looked like
That's
where people had been tied up, and as it turned out, that was the bed used in.
And so you saw several different people, obviously, in discomfort, probably being tortured, maybe even dead, and you could see that wrought iron headstand in the background.
The only picture that looked like somebody might have been dead, we found one photograph of a guy who was hanging by his feet. Picture looked like it had been taken in the basement.
Oh, wow.
And that photograph, I mean, there's no way to tell looking at a photograph somebody's dead, obviously.
Right.
But it did look like there was a possibility that this guy was possibly dead. The rest of them, there was no indication that they were dead, just being tortured
probably
or held against their will.
But at that point, would you really have pursued investigating beyond Chris's claims? I mean, you see, so you have Polaroid photos of what appear to be other men that are being maybe bound, maybe being tortured, but nobody's come forward to make any complaints, except for Chris.
Right. At that time, that's the only...
That's the case you want to make.
The only case we had at that point was Chris, yes.
But this is Saturday evening before Easter Sunday.
Yes.
So you stayed there. I assume you left the house guarded overnight. You probably didn't stay there all night, or maybe you did.
What I did was... I didn't see any evidence of murder at that point. And I was the only sergeant on the second floor at that
sergeant.
Point.
And you're the homicide sergeant, right.
And there's no other sergeants on the second floor to sign these May Eyes that we talked about earlier. So I called Roy Orth, who was the sergeant over in sex crimes. And I told Roy, I gave him a rundown, said it looks like this is probably going to be a good case for sex crimes. So Roy comes out and... I think he called in a couple of other sex crimes detectives to meet him out there. And at that point, I left and went back down to the second floor because I had to brief the sergeant who was going to be coming on duty for the 4 to midnight shift.
Right. You mean you left Bob Berdella's house and you
I
went
did.
To the
left
second
a lot
floor
of detectives
at,
out
at
there.
The
yeah, there was still
department.
A lot of police personnel there. But I personally left and went back to the second floor.
Had you been in the basement at that point?
Yeah, I'd been all over the house at that point. The only thing that we had the only other thing that was kind of got our attention, one of the detectives opened up a closet, and there was a skull sitting in the closet. It had had a package of teeth. There was an envelope with it, and there was teeth in the envelope.
Oh, wow. That sounds like you could immediately say this is a real skull.
Although you couldn't. He had several skulls in the house. Some of them were under glass. And they almost looked like artifacts or medical skulls or whatever.
Well, and the rumor had been, or the history is, that he actually had skulls at the flea market.
He did have several. He had four of them there, actually, at the flea market, as it turned out when we went there later.
So you go on back.
So I go back.
You get Roy to go out and take charge of the scene.
Roy comes out, takes charge of the scene, and let's see, I went on home after end of my shift and... Watched basketball.
NCAA tournaments. Yeah. Is this the year KU won it all?
Yeah, unfortunately.
I think it is.
Oh, man. And then enjoy Easter Sunday.
They were playing Oklahoma. But anyway...
Oh, I'm sorry, Troy. I should not have punched that little boil on your butt there, should I?
Well, I might add that Oklahoma had played them three times that year, and Oklahoma had beaten them all three times. So I had no reason to fear KU. But KU did win
until
it.
Until that fateful night.
But you still wanted to see it.
But anyway, I went home, and I just sat down and getting ready to watch the ball game and have dinner, and the phone rang, and it was my captain, Sylvester Winston. And he tells me that they've uncovered something out at the house that leads them to believe that they've got a possible homicide occurred. So he said, I think maybe you better go back out to the house and see what's going on.
Oh, boy.
So I rounded up a couple of other detectives. I called John Fraze and a couple of others. I think Bill Wilson. But anyway, I had them meet me at the house. So we donned. It was so bad. The stench had gotten so bad in there that we put on our white paper suits and our white little paper shoes. It was more mask as best we could just to stay in the house. It was.
I bet you took a shower as soon as you got home each day from this.
Well, that actually wasn't because there were like rotting dead corpses lying around. It was like the feces from the dogs.
Yeah, it mostly was.
You didn't really disturb the crime scene,
no,
if you will, because you wouldn't like, well, we should clean this up.
No, we weren't smelling death at that point. We were just smelling
dog shit.
Dog shit, yeah, that's pretty much
which
it.
Is bad enough.
Yeah, but Anyway, I go back down to the house. I don't know. I think I got there around 7, 8 o'clock that night. And, again, we're pouring through. The house is so cluttered, it's kind of hard to describe. But at that point, we don't know what's evidence and what's not. So we're basically scouring through every piece of paper and turning over everything we can just to see what might be evidence of a murder.
So what was it they found that got Captain Winston to call you back out with your squad?
The photograph of the guy hanging upside down.
Okay, they decided that would be.
I think I probably didn't make that clear, but that photograph wasn't found until after I had left.
Okay, yeah. All right, I got you.
And then
you.
They come across right. that photograph, and they said, man, this guy's got to be dead. You could see the liver, you know, on his extremities, his arms and neck.
Now, the liver on his extremities is, explain that.
Oh, well, it's the blood that has run down. When you die, the blood goes to the lower extremities, and it's called liver. And,
okay. It's like a bruising? It appears as a bruising?
Yeah, a bright pink, basically.
Oh, okay.
And it'll flow to wherever the lower extremities
right.
are. In this case, the guy's hanging upside down, so the liver was in his arms and chest and neck and head area because he was hanging from his feet, but... Anyway, they had found that photograph after I left, and that's why I got a call back down.
Were you able to identify anybody from the Polaroid photos? Did they go when they found like the 200-300 photos? They're like, well, there's Bob, there's another one of Bob, there's other people. Maybe like you said, the ones with Chris were pretty obvious.
The only people we knew in any of the photographs at that point would have been Berdella and Chris Bryson.
Yeah, we
didn't know any of the other players at that point.
That'll all come in.
That's part of
the investigation over the next several.
That was the biggest part of the investigation.
Biggest part of it over the next month or two.
So this guy who has liver appears in the photograph. The Polaroid did have liver for the settling of the blood in his body because he is dead. You still don't even know who he is.
No, we have no idea who he is. So at that point.
Do you just continue to kind of, you know, now you've been called back out? Or are you going to like, well, let's look around some more?
Yeah, I go back down and. I think I kept the squad there until about 2 a.m. on that Sunday morning, which would have been Easter Sunday. And, you know, we had an anthropologist. We called an anthropologist to the scene. He happened to be a K-State anthropologist that one of the captains on the police department was friends with him. And he called him and asked him, you know, could you come out and help us look at these skulls and give us your opinion as to whether or not they're artifacts or real deal people? And so he came out and he looked at the skull in the closet and he said, this skull is not that old and it appears to be a legitimate, it's not an artifact, in other words.
It's a legitimate human skull.
I think you got evidence of a murder here. And again, we had the teeth of that skull in the closet laying beside the skull. So at that point, we're going to have to start at least pursuing evidence, more evidence of murder. So I kept the guys there until about 2 a.m. I said, it's been a long day. Let's go home and come back and reconvene in the morning, 9 o'clock, which was Easter Sunday. So we go home, catch a little shut-eye, and come back the next morning. Captain Ron Cannaday was, at that time, he was in charge of the crime scene unit. He came out to the scene, and... We were assigning detectives to various rooms in the house, continuing to go through the mess of paperwork and whatever we could find. Cannaday, he and I are out walking around the house in the backyard. We spot a plot. We'll call it a plot for lack of a better word. It was just a section of ground in the backyard where there was two befores kind of laid out in the shape of a grave. It was about 3 to 4 feet wide and 5-6 feet long. And... Cannaday just off the top of his head, he just happened to make the comment, that could be a burial site right there.
Well, it was fresh turned earth.
Pardon me?
Was the earth turned there?
No, but you could tell the earth had been disturbed because there wasn't as much grass growing there as in the yard surrounding it.
Okay.
So obviously it had been disturbed at some point.
Right, and if Ron Cannaday said there might be something to that, you listen, don't you?
You probably should listen.
The guy had good instincts.
He did. And he said, I really think we should dig this yard up. And I certainly wasn't going to go against him. I said, you know, if you think that's a good idea, let's do it. So he calls the city, and they bring a backhoe out. Again, this is Easter Sunday. And he gets tobacco. We start in the backyard, and Kennedy tells the backhoe operator, he said, start digging right here where this little plot had been marked off with these 2x4s.
Now, I suppose I've always wondered about this. He probably gave him pretty specific instructions on how much to take out each time. He just didn't say just start digging, and you know, they'll just be like with a
he told him to go down about mallet. 12 to 18 inches.
Okay.
And just slowly come up, and then if we see anything, we'll
watch.
Stop you, and we'll go. So the backhoe operator goes to that particular area. The first scoop he brings up, there's nothing there. The second scoop that he brings up, there's a human head.
Oh, man.
And it's still got hair and skin attached
God.
To it.
Oh, my God. I bet you about
shit. So he wasn't bringing up, like, full bucket loads of dirt at this point. If you go down about, if you're like a normal backhoe.
It was a regular backhoe, huh?
So it's probably, you know, like, what, like about a quarter, half of the bucket filled as he's
probably not even that much.
Not even that much.
Yeah. It was, and when the backhoe brought it up, it still separated the jaw, the lower jaw from the rest of the skull. And again, it had hair and skin attached to it. So it was at that point that I knew we had a big deal going.
So this wasn't an Indian burial ground you'd stumbled across in his backyard, was it?
I don't think so. My first thought was, you know, if we dug up a skull on the second scoop.
What are you going to dig up?
How many of these are back here?
Really?
That was.
And John then, Wayne Gacy or something like that was in your mind, wasn't it?
At that point, what I'm trying to think is all the pictures that I had just viewed, the Polaroids, are all these people back here in the backyard
somewhere?
Yeah,
that's what I'd think.
That was my first thought.
Yeah.
So I guess the realization, that was my first realization that this was a real deal case and Chris Bryson wasn't just telling us a fantasy story.
Right. It's interesting that it's always a conundrum for a policeman to, you have to, when you get confronted with something, especially something that's like just kind of way out of left field and away from normal kind of society, the first thing is suspicion. Let's make sure that this story, let's check. Trust God and tie your camel, you know, let's check the facts on this and then let's make sure. And people don't like that a lot of times. Well, what do you mean? You don't believe me. And they get make a lot of people mad by going through because they accuse you of being prejudiced. Oh, you just don't like gay people.
Yep.
And I noticed in that weird film that one guy said, well, the first thing we thought was that they just didn't like gay people. The police, they're prejudiced against gay people. So it's kind of part of that fine line you have to walk.
Yeah.
But you got to do it in order to conduct a thorough investigation. You got to be suspicious.
Well, if you had kicked the door open and it smelled so bad that the animal control didn't want to go in, I mean, what would you have done? Just kind of like, well, we'll walk away.
Yeah.
Can't really.
Yeah.
You're just going to charge Bob with sodomy and let it be at that. Yeah. That's good enough for me.
Charge him in city court with raping this guy and go ahead.
Yeah.
No, that's part of the job.
Even though you kind of had a suspicion that maybe it was just kind of a, you know, Oliver's quarrel, if you will, or something like that, you know, kind of your experience would tell you that as you got further and further into the house and into the situation and then you're digging in the backyard and you just go, you know, I would think that premise kind of unwinds for you. And then, like you said, you think, you know, that we have got this envelope with all these Polaroids in it, how many bodies am I going to find?
Yeah. Now, as my memory serves me, probably about that time, that's when you started figuring out that Bob Berdella was what we call a fruit hustler. He would go out and find young men who were on the streets and bring them into his house and offer money for sex. Were you starting to figure that out about this time when you think about who these people who were victims that they came into under his control?
Well, we didn't know who any of the victims were at that point other than Chris Bryson. And we really didn't know that much about Chris Bryson at that point. Chris had first told us he was picked up by Berdella and a female.
Yeah, he was told two or three different stories,
yeah.
I believe, which is common.
Which is common. And so at that point, we're not sure what his background is either. So it wasn't until we really started getting into the background of some of the other victims that it became obvious that was, you know, the way what you alluded to was probably what was happening. He was bringing these people to his house for sex in exchange for money or other favors. We weren't sure. But that wasn't obvious to us at that point.
You just knew there was people have been murdered there, and there was pictures of them probably.
We just knew that we had at least one real head that hadn't been in the ground very long. Again, Dr. I can't remember that anthropologist's name. But anyway, he examined the head that we dug up, and he said this head has probably been in the ground, I think he said, somewhere between 3 and 9 months was his estimation at that point. And but again, at that point, we all realized we've got a homicide case, at least one, and probably more at that point. So we stopped the digging at that point. Gary Howell, from the he was in charge of the regional crime lab, he came in and lended his expertise, and we plotted off, or Gary basically plotted off the entire yard of Berdella's into small, I think like 2x4 sections, and we called out the recruits from the police academy the next day and assigned each one of them a plot, and they got on their hands and knees and dug it up, you know, basically by hand.
Well, just with the garden trowels or something?
With shovels.
Shovels. Uh-huh.
And anyway,
very much like an anthropologist would do, because you're trying to uncover a crime scene, but you don't want to disturb it.
Destroy it, right. But anyway, we again, our first thought is we're probably going to have a whole bunch of these heads buried back here. And as it turned out, that was the only head that was buried in the yard. So,
how long were they back there digging?
I think those recruits were there about 3 or 4 days, as I recall.
Wow. Mm-hmm. How deep did each one of them go before you said, okay, that's deep enough?
I think like they went approximately 2 or 3 feet, is what I recall, yeah. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they would come across every once in a while, they'd hit a bone. And the anthropologist, he stayed on scene.
He just stayed on scene with you.
He stayed on scene to help us. And he would look at it, and he'd say, oh, that's a chicken, and that's a bird, and this is a pig or a cow. Yeah. You know, he could do that. And but he turned out he was a big help. I don't know what we'd have done without him. But
Well, I bet if anybody was kind of relieved, it would have been Roy Orth.
Yeah, now it gets kicked from sex crimes back to homicide.
Yeah, where it's all of a sudden,
Aaron,
like,
you know how this job works.
I'm like, this is probably not a sex crime anymore. Yeah. I can go back to my desk.
But the day after Easter, when we reconvened on the Monday morning, that's when I got assigned the case. Colonel Bob Jenkins was in charge of the Investigations Bureau at that time, and he called me up to his office, and he said, I'm going to form a special squad, and we'll call it the Berdella Squad, and I want you to be the sergeant in charge of it. So that was the beginning of of a long three or four months for me. But anyway, that's how we got started.
Well, this might be another appropriate time to just take a pause.
Yeah, I probably would. You know, we're forming the special squad now, and starting to branch out and try to identify who all these victims might be, because you could say, you could even find the evidence that the guy probably killed somebody, but you don't know who he killed. You got to figure out who he killed. And that is, and these people were, they're going to find out were kind of rootless. They didn't have close family ties around. Nobody was really missing them. So it becomes a heck of a job of policing and investigation, detective, to find out who these are. So this is a compelling story, Troy, and I salute you for having to be inside that house. I've been in a few houses, but I never spent that much time in them, and I never found anything but cat shit or dog shit.
What you really want to be there in the backyard is the backhoe's digging away, right, and all you can go is, that. Oh Lord, let it be a sex crime.
Yeah, really. You can't unsee that head coming up with the hair attached to it, can you, Troy?
No, that was. That was a day I'll never forget.
Oh, I can't even imagine what that'd be like. All right. Well, you know, if you have a friend, relative, or employee, or anybody you care about that has a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, Or check their website at www.firstcallkc.org. Aaron, I think we're ready to go out tonight, and we'll come back with a third chilling episode of
at least a third. I mean, now we're really
Robert
just
Berdella.
At the point that he's kind of, now the case has to go from being sodomy to kind of charging Bob with a murder, because they've got him incarcerated still, And as interesting as it can be, you're going to have to wait till the next episode to hear more.
Right, a little police procedural tip. When you get in this situation, you've got the one crime. You've got the good, solid one crime you can charge him with, and you don't want to let him go, so you get him charged with that one good, solid crime with a high enough bond that he can't get out. So we'll talk about that next time.
Remember to download the Kansas City Mob Tour app. For $1.99, you can take your own personal tour of notorious mob locations in and around Kansas City. We may even add Bob Bordella's house as an address on that.
I'm sure those people in Hyde Park would like that.
Even though the house no longer there.
But there is a vacant lot. You know, I went by it, Troy, and I can hardly tell that it was ever there.
I know.
It's amazing.
I haven't been by there in several years.
They've landscaped that really nicely where you can't really tell.
Yep. Dale Dunmire, I think Dale Dunmire actually...
He bought that house.
He bought the house, and I'm not sure that he didn't pay for the demolition of that, too.
It seemed like he did. He's a rich guy.
He's dead now.
He was a bank robber and then made a ton of money and became a philanthropist in Kansas City and bought a bunch of stuff, bought the first vest for the highway patrol, the first...
He bought guns for the narcotics task force.
That's right, guns for the Jackson County Drug Task Force.
Yes. And
I think he bought all the state troopers' bulletproof vest and or maybe some other guns. I can't remember, but he did a lot of stuff. All right, Aaron, let's get out of here.
Remember to download the Kansas City Mob Tour app and then listen to Gangland Wire, the podcast. Share, subscribe, and support the work that we do here by putting a hit out on our donate button. For a donation of $25 or more, we will release some exclusive episodes for you to listen to.
That, and we'll give you a DVD of Gangland Wire.
Autographed by Gary Jenkins.
If anybody cares about my autograph. I've given a few autographs out. Troy, you laugh. Troy's laughing at me.
No, I'm not laughing at you. I'm laughing with you.
And remember to get the Kindle book, or you can look online for Rites of Burial.
By Troy Cole and Tom Jackman. All right, say goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Aaron. Music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Follow them on Facebook at Odd-O-Matic Music.